It is now 8 o'clock, time for this morning's talk. And somebody asked last night, can you please explain more about letting go? What is wisdom that allows letting go? So, can you let me go? Shall we cancel the talk this morning? No. All about letting go is you have to make sure that you know what to let go of. Because sometimes people let go of the wrong things. So it's my joy and duty, and it's important to give like the 8 o'clock talk in the morning. So I will always do that. That's when you're here. When you're gone, I won't give a talk here. So letting go is, first of all, what are you letting go of? And when we are practicing our meditation, the one thing which we should focus on is to let go of especially control. Because we all know that when a person's a control freak, when you're a control freak, or you have to work with control freaks, it's really, really difficult life for you. We always think we know what needs to be done and how to do it. And sometimes, you know, we just, instead of letting people learn and make mistakes, we actually try and tell them what to do and how to do it. It's one thing which I remember, and I called it in one of the stories, which was in one of my books, the 70% rule. And this is an important part of letting go, to remember the 70% rule. And that is when I had to compose a test at the school I was teaching in on maths. It's the first time I'd ever set an exam. And I asked other teachers, what should I do? And the advice they gave me, which was one of the best pieces of advice I've ever heard, it was simple at first, but I realized that this was actually quite deep and could apply to so many different things in life. He said, make sure you don't set the exam too hard. Because if everybody, the average score is like 30%, 3 out of 10 or something, then all the children in your class will come away thinking they can't do maths. No, they can't do maths, it's the teacher just gave too tough an exam. But if you make it too easy, they all get 95%, 98%, then that would mean that, you know, it's a stupid exam, it's not really testing anybody. He said, try and make the average score 70%. And if you get the average score of 70%, then number one, everybody will understand, or they come away thinking, yeah, they can do maths. Not a bad score, 70%. But the most important part is the 30% where they make mistakes. That's where me, as their teacher, can recognize their weak spots. Those parts of maths which I thought I'd taught them and they didn't understand properly. So I can address those weaknesses in the next couple of lessons. And I realize that's the same in life. If you always get 100% in life, you're very successful, but it's pretty boring. You don't really learn or grow very much. If you only get 20 or 30% in life, again, you get depressed. But 70%, yeah, well done, you can do this thing called life. And the 30% where you fail, that is the growing part of life, where you learn and get better. And so that was also important for me to understand that even in meditation, please understand, you won't always get good meditations. Can you do 70%? I said, Ajahn Brahm, it's more like 7%. Because you set the exams too hard, so let go a little bit. And just when you're meditating, instead of meditating to try and get some results, meditate to see if you can let go of wanting things like results. Let go of the right things, not the wrong things. There was one of the Western Buddhist many years ago. That he was listening to the talks, he got inspired, so he decided to take the five Buddhist precepts. He told me it was very great difficulty keeping those precepts and also socialising at work. At his work, they had a party or some celebration, and then somebody came around with the drinks, the alcoholic drinks. He said, "No, have a drink, have a beer." He said, "No, no, no, I'm a Buddhist now. I keep the five precepts, I don't take alcohol." And the fellow serving the drink said, "Oh, you're a Buddhist. Yeah, Buddhist is a really nice religion. It's a great path. It's all about letting go. Come on, let go, have a beer." It's letting go of the wrong thing. It's the same when people say something which is close to letting go, like attachment. You gotta let go of attachments, aren't you? Haven't you supposed to let go of attachments? Please. As I tell many people overseas, don't need to tell them so much here in Australia because it doesn't relate so much, but I think you can understand the simile. If you're on the back of a motorbike in Bangkok, do not let go. Please be attached. Otherwise, you'll fall off and get hurt. There is a time to attach. There is a time to let go. We have to know what we're trying to let go of. And when is the time to stick to something? Now, what we're trying to let go of, again, is control, wanting, desire, craving, ill will, all those things which you might call like hindrances. When you let go of something, there's always something left. So when we let go of doing things, what's left is being. So if you don't like the word let go, you can use the other alternative, let it be. So what actually, is this contradictory? Not at all. Because you're letting be of what's here right now, this, whatever it is. Let this moment be. And let go of trying to go somewhere else. Or return to somewhere where you were before. Let go of all this wanting. When you don't want anything, you really let go of wanting, you're actually here, you're being. It's one of the reasons why, just as a little joke, this will probably be on the whiteboard tomorrow from Leha. When you go into town, whether it's a city like Perth or a city like New York or Singapore, wherever you come from, there are many people but not many human beings. Very rare to see a human being in London. You see many human goings, but very rare to see a human being. They're always on a journey somewhere, going some other place. They're never really here. So how do you come here so you can let this moment be? Just let go of wanting, let go of doing anything. And to make it quite clear, there was Ajahn Chah's simile. And if you criticize me for always repeating these similes, Ajahn Chah would always repeat these similes again and again and again and again and again and again and again until you would understand them. And that meant repeating them many, many more times. They were simple, but they were very, very deep. He would actually, because he didn't have any visual aids, he would just use whatever was available to him, and he'd just put up his hand and he would wave it like this. And he said, "This represents a leaf on a tree." Because he would use a lot of similes from the forest and the jungles where he spent most of his time. "This is a leaf on a tree. It only moves because of the wind. If the wind stopped, the leaf would still carry on moving, but less and less and less, until after a time it will become perfectly still. It will be stationary. It wouldn't move at all. Because that's its natural state. What we call these days the default state of the leaf is to be still. It only moves because something outside of it is making it move." And then he said, "That's the same with the human mind. If you try to let it go and make it let go, it's not really letting go if you make it let go, because it'll keep on moving. Instead, we just leave it alone. We make sure there's no wind blowing on the mind. And after a while, if you make sure there's no wind blowing on the mind, it moves less and less and less until it becomes perfectly still, all by itself. And that wind, the wind which makes the mind move, is called wanting. Now in Pali, they use the word dhanha. And sometimes, again, the translation in English, the usual one of craving, is far too intense. Craving is a very strong form of wanting. But even the very lesser forms of wanting still make your mind move. Even wanting good things, even like thoughts of kindness for other beings, that still makes the mind move. If you have no wanting at all, you're in this hall, just meditating, not wanting anything in the whole world, literally, you're letting go of the things we should be letting go of craving, of wanting. And what's left, you let it be. It takes a while for the mind to become still. And because people are always so impatient, there is something which comes up in people's meditation every retreat. Sometimes, you know, you hit the mark and you have a very lovely meditation. And then what happens next is they think, wow, yes, I can do it now. And the next meditation is terrible. And they ask, why is it that sometimes you get a very good meditation, the next meditation is awful? Meditations aren't awful. But the answer which I came up with is also a legitimate joke as well. Makes people laugh. But it's also, it's not just a joke. It's a story which shows why you can't expect every meditation to hit the spot. It was a story of the migrant who came over to Australia from his home country. And he was a doctor in his home country. But here, his qualifications didn't count. So he had to find any job to feed himself and his family. He got a job as a worker on a building site. He used to be a doctor before. He was still, you know, young and fit, so he worked really hard. And when he went home on Monday, his wife said, how much did you earn today? And he was a bit embarrassed. He said, nothing. Didn't get any pay at all. Tuesday, Wednesday, the same. Didn't get paid. He wasn't even going to go to work on Thursday, but his wife forced him to. Go on, get to work, see what happens. And he really worked hard on Thursday. But at the end of the day, he went home. He didn't get any money at all. He said, you know, these Australians, they just exploit migrants. I work really, really hard and don't get anything, nothing from all that hard work I've done. And on Friday, he had nothing else to do, so he went to work anyway. And he only worked for an hour or two. And then the boss came up to him and gave him a big pay packet, lots of money. When he went home, he told his wife, I've finally figured out how it works in Australia. From now on, I'm only going to go to work on Fridays. And of course, there's a certain logic there for someone who doesn't know how it works. Same as you only want to meditate when it's payday. So all the other meditations, when it was a bit tough, you didn't really manage to sort of, you know, really get right in there and get some nice peace and happiness. It doesn't matter. That's where you go into work and your credit is increasing. And for those of you who've been here, was it 4 or 5 days already? And you still haven't got paid yet, don't worry. The check's in the mail. It will come somewhere along the line. So what we're letting go of, what Ajahn Chah was saying, let go of the wanting. And with the wanting, expecting, that's part of wanting. You expect something to happen. That's what happens with when people do letting go. Come on, I'm going to let go. Now Ajahn Brahm said letting go. He's a good monk. All these other great teachers said letting go. I'm going to let go. Okay, let go. Let go. Let go. Let go. Of course, that is just an exaggeration of what happens in people's minds, but many people could recognize that and relate to it, which is why you laughed. It is sometimes when we force our mind to let go, of course, that's not letting go at all. That's more controlling. So what letting go is very beautifully described as really getting into this moment, being silent. That's a very powerful way of letting go. Just real good mindfulness of the moment. Because if you are really in this moment, I mentioned when there's no future for you, the whole concept of the future has disappeared for a while. There's no place for desire to land. You can have a desire, but where's it going to? There's no future for you in your meditation. It's just now. And the past, when I was a student, I was well enough versed in meditation that when it came to my final exams, I had an edge, an advantage over my fellow students, because the final exams in theoretical physics, there were over 6 days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, in a row. Morning exam, 3 hours. Afternoon exam, 3 hours. With an hour for lunch in between. It was horrendous that they would do that to students. 6 days in a row, 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours in the afternoon. But anyway, we all had the same schedule. But I always made sure I had a big lunch, a big breakfast, and never any lunch those 6 days. Because instead of lunch, I went to my room, sat down on my cushion, and meditated. I remember that experience so clearly, and it was instructive on what happens and how to deal with stress and learn how to let go and relax. Because as soon as I closed my eyes, it was automatic. The first thing which I thought of was the morning exam. It's high stress. I often tell people these days, if only I had known I was going to become a monk, I wouldn't have worried so much. But of course, you never knew that, and everyone was trying to tell you to do well. So, morning exam, started thinking of the first thing I thought of in the lunchtime meditation, the exam which I just finished, 3-hour exam on something like quantum physics or something. And you started thinking, did I do the answer correctly or wrongly? Did I make a mistake? Should I add in more explanation? You know what people do when they worry about the past. But it was so clear to me. If it's an exam, you know so clearly that right or wrong, it's finished. You can't change it. You can't stop it now. It's finished. The exam papers are in. So why worry about it? It's so clear when it's an examination. But in your life, we think about the past as if we could change it. It's done. It's finished. You can't go back and change it unless you know that gentleman called Doctor Who. Remember Doctor Who and his time machine, the TARDIS? That program was on when I was a kid. Of course it's still going now because he travels in time. 46 years old, royal day, he's still going. But anyway, if there's no time travel, you can't change the past. It's gone, it's finished, so you might as well let it go. The wisdom which allows you to let go. You can't do anything about it. It's finished. So leave it alone. And some people always keep saying that you have to keep remembering the past. If you don't remember the past, you won't learn anything. Oh, what a stupid thing that is to say. You learn much more from the present moment than you ever learn from the past. Try it and see. So anyway, so that allowed me to have the confidence to let go of the morning exam. And also, it was important, if I kept on thinking about the morning exam during my lunch break, I'd be like using up all the energy of my brain. I couldn't afford to use up any more energy. I was tired. It was a very stressful week. So because of that, I had the means and the confidence to let go of the past. Ah, oh, that was nice. What was the next thing which came up in my mind? The future exam coming in about half an hour's time. And I tell students this, and it's, you may remember this, everything you swat up in the last hour before the exam starts. I thought of getting out of my seat and going through my notes and doing some final revision. Everything you read an hour before the exam never, ever comes up in the paper. Never. Total waste of time. So anyway, who knows what the future could be? So I let go of worrying about the future exam so I could be in the present moment. Now, the wonderful thing when you let go of the past and future is actually you're becoming real. You're here. You're experiencing what's happening right now. And that's when I got a shock. And my shock was that I was sitting down on a nice, comfortable seat in my room, let go of the past, let go of the future, and I noticed my body was shaking. I didn't realize I was so nervous. And what really concerned me, that not that I was shaking, but I hadn't noticed that at all. How much of the bodily problems we have, when they begin, we don't even notice they're there. Maybe some friends tell them, oh, you're shaking. Say, no, I'm not. Oh, yes, I am. Why can't we notice it ourselves? Because we're too busy in the future and the past. So once I saw that, there was a problem there. It's understandable. This was final examinations. I was told my career depended upon it, which was rubbish. But I believed that, and so I was really putting full effort, very nervous. But once you can see your body shaking, you're aware of it, it's not that hard to calm it down. So the physical shaking stopped. How you calm it down is a lot of like trial and error. You try this, you try that, until everything starts to relax. Now it is the old hit and miss, trial and error, see what works. But when you are aware, mindful, you do get this feedback. I know how I feel now. I know how I feel in the next moment. I know how I feel in the moment afterwards. So you can learn very quickly from that how to relax the body so it becomes nice and still. And that was always, every day, that was a third part of the meditation, to relax the body. And the fourth part of the meditation was, again, it shocked me the first day I did this. It was so mind-blowing to know how your body and mind worked. It was obvious afterwards, it was just logical. But my looked at my brain, my body had relaxed, my mind and brain was exhausted. I felt so tired. I'd just done a 3-hour exam. And of course it was exhausted. Like many people have an exhausted mind most of their lives. They don't even notice it, because they're too busy in the past or the future, too busy doing things. When you stop, you find out just how your brain is. Really tired. No mistakes, no faults, nothing to blame. It's just what happens when you do such exams. So once I noticed my brain was tired, you could just be with it, calm, peaceful, not trying to change it. This was the important part, caring for it, not trying to cure it. Just like the Emperor's Three Questions, I was aware in this moment of my brain, or it's like its energy levels or tiredness levels. I just cared for it. And it's amazing just when you do nothing, the energy comes back again. Sometimes people feel a bit afraid of letting go. If I let go, everything will go wrong. If I don't do something, it will get worse. But the opposite usually happens. It surprises you. If you really relax and let things be, you find that things do get healed themselves. You ever notice if you have a wound on your body, you put a band-aid on it, and a lot of the times, because it's protected, it heals itself. We have to be careful on this, because sometimes people put a band-aid on them, and they said, after 5 minutes, is it better yet? They have a look. Not yet. And then they start worrying. And they think, oh, maybe I should put some ointment on. So take the band-aid off, put some ointment, put the band-aid back on. And they think maybe it's the wrong ointment, so they take it off and put some new ointment on. And they always interfere with it. They don't allow it to heal. A lot of times, inactivity, stillness, that things happen when you get out of the way. So the body has its own healing mechanisms. And for my brain, when I got out of the way and just let it relax, it got its energy back. It's only half an hour. But I tell people in the way I tell the story, and my friends confirm this is what happened in the afternoon examinations. I was the only person who went into the, only student went into the exam hall in the afternoon smiling. And they were really surprised. They really told me afterwards, they thought I was cheating. I was in a way, but not in an illegal way. I just had this extra ability, learned how to regenerate my energies in just the half an hour lunch break. So anyway, that was an example of letting go of the correct things. When you do let go of the correct things, then you're mindful, aware, then you know whether you're going to let go or not let go. You know what letting go is, and you know how it works. It's not wanting anything. It's another reason why. You said it in a different manner when you said about the thousand petal lotus. You know, it's a very accurate way of meditating. You just, mindfulness is the light, your kindness is the warmth, and that opens up lotuses. It's very simple. Or what I didn't say in this talk so far, or in this meditation retreat so far, is how Ajahn Chah described this. You know, his method of meditation. Was it Anapanasati? Was it Vipassana? How did Ajahn Chah teach meditation? And this is the story he told again and again and again and again for the first 3 months when I was with him. With him for 9 years. And he said this at the very beginning. He never said it again. And at the time he said this story, I rejected it. I thought it was a crazy story. It made no sense to me. And only later on, when my meditation improved, did I realize how accurate and beautiful that simile was. And that was a simile of the mango orchard. Ajahn Chah said his monastery, Wat Pa Phong, was a mango orchard with the mango trees planted by the Buddha. Now remember, I had a science background. If the Buddha had planted a mango tree 2,500 years later, that would be gone, be dead, finished. But, sort of, he said, those trees were planted by the Buddha. And he said, right now, those mangoes on those mango trees planted by the Buddha are ripe. And there's thousands of them. But, he said, in a mango tree planted by the Buddha with all these juicy ripe mangoes on them, you cannot reach them by stretching your hand. You cannot get a ladder to reach them. You can't climb up the tree trunk or shake the tree to get those mangoes to fall. And the other way they used to get mangoes to fall, throwing sticks up at them. They won't fall. He said there's only one way to get the mangoes from the trees planted by the Buddha. Only one way. And Ajahn Chah said, you have to sit perfectly still, underneath that mango tree. And hold out your hand, and a mango will fall, just like that. You'll understand why I rejected that. That's stupid. Mangoes don't fall just when you sit perfectly still. If they do fall, it's very unlikely they fall in your hand, maybe on your head. But and so I rejected that for so many years until you finally started to get some understanding of meditation and know what a beautiful, beautiful story that was. It's a great simile. You sit quietly. Opening out your hand is like opening up your loving kindness. Still and kind and these things fall into your hand themselves. You don't need to climb a tree. You don't need to shake anything. Relax. Calm down. And all these things, they fall into your mind rather than you go chasing them and seeking them. So this is the wisdom which gives you some confidence to let go. You don't need always to go chasing things in life, which is how you were taught from the time you were young. At school, come and do your homework, work harder, read more books, do this, do that. Always pushing you to achieve. Instead of here, we're going totally the opposite way. Sitting still. And all the things you ever wanted will come to you. What do you really want in life? The most important things, those are the ones which come when you don't want anything at all. Peace. Health. And the other thing which was important to me was joy, happiness, pleasure. I always was very confused. Is that like a craving, wanting happiness and pleasure? Or is it just the nature of the human mind, always inclined towards what is beautiful, pleasurable, delightful? And after all these years, you realize there are two types of pleasures: the pleasure which leads to suffering, and it's a pleasure which leads to peace. You come to this meditation retreat. Are you enjoying this retreat? If you are, it's a pleasure which is leading to peace. You could be off, you know, I don't know what you can do these days, watching movies on Netflix or something. But that's a pleasure which doesn't lead to peace. This is something which was, it's actually in the Arana Vibhanga Sutta, if anyone wants to look it up, the pleasures to be followed and the pleasures to be avoided. And the pleasures to be followed are the pleasures which arrive when you start to let go. It starts on simple things. Now, have you ever been really generous? You see someone who's hungry, you just give them your lunch. You know you're going to go hungry yourself. Or, you know, somebody is, oh, they're looking for some money to pay, you know, the fee for the car park. You say, oh, no, I'll do that for you. You just do it. When you really let go, you don't have to, but you do it. All those little acts of kindness, giving, that's a part of letting go. And you always get so much more happiness when you give to others than you get it for yourself. I don't have much chance to do that service. Now I'm a monk, except to give my time for others and give as much as I can when I'm teaching. But I still remember a time when I was a lay Buddhist. And as I say, going to many of these talks by these great monks and teachers about Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, I was really bored stiff. That's why I fell asleep many times. But when there was a Tibetan nun, this is one of Western, but in Tibetan tradition, she was saying she was working in an orphanage up in the north of India. And she's a very humble woman and obviously working really, really hard. And I was so inspired. I never went to sleep that night or that talk. I was so inspired. The following day, I went to my bank and got out £20 to give as a donation to this nun. And I don't know why I did. That was a lot of money for a student. Now, my father was dead. My mother was like a typist secretary. I couldn't get any money from her. And I getting odd jobs during the holiday season, trying to make some money to pay the bills. I was really poor. But £20 in those days to give us my donation to this orphanage, that physically, that hurt me. The next fortnight, I went hungry. I still had enough to eat, but I didn't have as much as I usually did. I had to do without a few things. But I always remember that donation to this day and just how one of the best £20 I've ever spent just giving to somebody. It made me feel so good. And every time I remember that, the karma comes back. Giving. Letting go. And just seeing the joy which comes from it. And of course, whenever there is any letting go, there's always some fear. Are you letting go? Will I have enough to eat? You let go of, of your indulgences. Oh, am I going to be able to do this and I'm not speaking for 8 or 9 days? Am I going to be able to survive with only just the meals in the morning, nothing in the evening? I know that some of you have got secret stashes in your rooms. But I don't mind that. Because, you know, there's a lot of kindness. You know, you're doing very well. But there's a lot of fear when you do something different. You have to let go of your comfort blankets, of your biscuits, of your instant noodles, or whatever else you've got in your house. But, you know, sometimes when you do let it go, there's a great sense of joy and happiness comes. It's like your freedom. You're not owned by your biscuits or by your noodles. That, you know, you can let them go. And that's one of the things I remember when I gave up drinking alcohol as a student. That was really scary for me, simply because that all my friends drank alcohol. And that was your social life. And I thought, wow, I'm really going to struggle now. But then, as soon as I did that, I thought this great sense of power. I was like more in control of my desires rather than my desires controlling me. Sometimes, you know, you just wonder, just know who's in charge here. Your cravings, your wants, your desires, or something much wiser than that. So he said, had a sense of power coming up. I always remember that. Just felt like, instead of being being driven along by a current of life, whatever everybody else was doing, and being really so concerned what other people thought of me. No, this is what I want to do. And I decided to do it. Scary at first, but so pleasurable afterwards. And that is one of the things which actually motivates letting go. That it's so more happy when you do let go of these things. It's much more joyful when you can let go of the past. And all the stuff which happened to you, all the rotten things which other people did to you, it's a sense of freedom. It's like you've been carrying this heavy backpack around your shoulders for ever since you can remember. And you think, why do I have to do that? Why do I have to feel guilty or in pain or angry about what's in the past? I don't know why they did that or why I did that. It's such a long time ago. And now you have these moments of inspiration. I call it inspiration when people like me come along and say, you can let it go. And you take it off, put it down, and walk away. You don't have those bad memories to carry around ever again. When you look at it, again, with some reason, why do people keep carrying those past memories? It is like, you know, that somebody comes along and calls you stupid. And then you say, why do they call me stupid? They've no right to call me stupid. It's wrong to call me stupid. It's so uncultured to call me stupid. And then you figure out that you've just allowed them to call you stupid 5 more times. Every time you remember it, they're calling you stupid again. Why do you do that? They call you stupid, call you stupid once, don't even think about it again. Which means it only ever hurts you once. Same with the past, whatever someone did to you. Why they did that, who knows? But at least you can let it go. It's in the past. It's distant. Do some, what they call these days, social distancing from the past so it does not infect you. And then you know it's letting go because it gives you this great sense of peace and freedom and joy and happiness. One of the signs of letting go is joy, a beautiful joy. And every now and again you see these stories of incredible states, incredible acts of letting go. One of the latest ones which I read was this lady, I think she passed away about a year ago, but she was in Auschwitz. That's a pretty sort of heavy place to be. She survived, and the only reason she survived because she was one of two twins. So instead of being gassed, they were experimented on by these doctors, Mengele and his assistants. And she was more like the control of the experiment. Her sister, twin sister, she received most of the torture and eventually died in Auschwitz. But she survived, but carried that trauma with her for so many years until she found out that one of those doctors, who was assistant of Dr. Mengele, she found out where he was. She sent him a letter. Please meet me in Auschwitz. This was many, many, many years later when it was almost like this very somber museum. And he did. And when she met him, she formally gave this wonderful act of forgiveness to him, saying, for what you did to me and my sister, it's forgiven. It's a long time ago. I let it go. I want you to know that I've let it go. And it was incredible that degree of pain, hurt, abuse, torture, that she could let go of. She said, I did that because all these many years beforehand, I was a victim. As soon as I forgave, I was a victor. I defeated, that pain of the past. So I never need to be tortured by the memories anymore. And there's a beautiful act of letting go. Those are big things. Even the smaller problems of letting go. There's this other story, I'm just reminded of it because I mentioned Auschwitz. There was this backpacker American many years ago, and he was backpacking around Europe. In those days, it was very easy. You could just go hitchhiking or traveling, and you'd go to a city, get a job for a few days, a couple of weeks, and then you get paid and fed, and then you go to the next place when you had enough money. And he was in Vienna. He was working in a restaurant, serving sometimes, helping cooking or washing up. And one day the owner got all the staff together and said, by some mistake, we've ordered too much sauerkraut. So we've got heaps of sauerkraut to get rid of. So he said, if you want free food, breakfast, lunch, dinner, I don't care, sauerkraut. You can have that for free. Anything else you have to pay for. Sauerkraut is this pickled cabbage, basically cabbage and vinegar. If you're a German, go and ask Amanda, it's over the road there, he loves that. But for other people, it makes you sick. But anyway, they said, that's all you can eat, sauerkraut. And the American, as Americans are, not all Americans, but some, because there's a few Americans here, I better be careful. Yeah. But the American said, you can't do this to us. This is wrong. It's well known. You go to restaurants, you get a free food and a few tips, and that's how you make enough money to go to the next place. This is really not right. We shouldn't allow this. We should all get together and go on strike or do something. He was very upset. And that was when the old cook came out. And the main cook came out and just bared his arm. See these numbers on my arm here? I was in Auschwitz. And he said that being in Auschwitz, every morning you didn't know whether you'd be alive to go to bed that night. said, I call that a problem. Having sauerkraut for breakfast, lunch and dinner is just an irritation. I want you to know the difference between a problem and an irritation. And I always remember that. There's so many irritations in life, but please don't make them problems. Problems are really big. Having sauerkraut for breakfast, lunch and dinner. Yeah, it's an irritation, but it's not really a problem. So many of much of life we can let go of. Just letting go of irritations, that's all. Which means we can have so much more peace and happiness. I mean, literally, peace and happiness. The other thing which I found all these years, that sometimes people don't like peace. They sometimes feel a bit afraid of happiness. In theory, they want it, yeah. But I noticed this just over the road. There's no mugs here, which is good. Except me. Over the road at Bodhinyana Monastery. Sometimes things go really peaceful, very nice, no problems at all. It's as if, like, you need to have a drama, at least one a week. So something goes wrong, something happens. And at first I thought, just bad luck. But these days I think, is it really bad luck, or do the monks actually need a problem every now and again? They have an excuse not to meditate. And there's a lot of truth to that, actually. Over all these years I've been a monk, that sometimes even for you, all these lovely days to meditate, nothing to do. But sometimes you miss the dramas of life, so much so that something gets exaggerated so you can have a bit of drama. Something to worry about instead of just sitting there peaceful and quiet. We are attached to suffering. So much so that when it starts to disappear too fast, oh, hold on a bit. I'm going to make some suffering so I can feel at home. So when you see that, it's much easier to let go because you know what's going on. But you know it's letting go because you feel so much peace. Those of you who are... Can you feel the peace of this site here? If you can't, we'll send you into the shopping centre to get some things for Leha. I may need some more food or something to make the meals the next few days. I did that to this one German man. He was here for the 3-month range retreat. And he said that he was so disappointed, his meditation was getting nowhere. He said, just nothing was really happening. I knew what was going on. I knew the solution. I said, oh, well, if your meditation's no good, we do need some stuff from the shopping centre. Would you mind just driving and getting it for us? So, yeah, might as well do something good instead of just wasting my time meditating. So off he went. When he came back again, he handed the stuff over which we needed. He said, wow, you wouldn't believe just those shopping centres, how noisy they are, how crazy they are. There's a mad place over there. And I said, you used to almost live in places like that. You have made progress. But you didn't notice it, did you? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. He said, because sometimes the progress we make over here, sometimes our mindfulness and our level of perception is not strong enough to actually notice you have got much more peaceful than when you first came here a few days ago. Much more peaceful. Letting go does have amazing rewards. And when you go home, eventually, you come back, you remember this place, oh, so peaceful. You won't remember the bad jokes, I hope. Or maybe you will, probably. But what really stands out is just the peace of the place. You get up early in the morning or in the afternoon or some other time, and you just listen and you feel how quiet this is. And that is a pleasure, a delight, it's a comfort, it's a security, it's a safety in peace and quiet, which once you can recognize, you recognize, that's what we let go for. And sometimes you work so hard in your life to try and get somewhere. What are you trying to get? That's why one of my friends over in town, I was in the town on the weekend doing all sorts of stuff. And I was taking some papers into the office. This is in our city centre. And he just arrived for the afternoon meditation on a Saturday. And he said to me, "Hi, Jambrone, how are you going?" And stupid me replied, "Yeah, I'm getting there." Have you said that before? "I'm getting there." And he was smart enough to pick me up and said, "Getting where, Ajahn Brahm?" Okay, you busted me. So I'm getting to my grave, that's where I'm going. And so instead, the next time he saw me, "Ajahn Brahm, how are you?" I didn't say "I'm getting there" anymore. I said, "I'm being here." Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Little by little, we learn the wisdom of being here rather than getting somewhere. Are you trying to get somewhere in your meditation? You are, aren't you? Be honest. Stop trying to get somewhere. Be here. Here is not such a bad place, you know. The more you are being here, the more peaceful you're getting, the more joy you're getting. If you're trying to get somewhere, it's only a few days left. Ah, I haven't got to delightful breath yet. Ah, I need to get to Nimittas. Ah. No, if you want to have experiences, then be here. That's where the experiences are. And number two, once you are here, are you happy to be here? Really? Or do you really want to go somewhere else? One of the little mantras which I suggest people use in their meditation. As you're meditating, you're reasonably peaceful. Ask yourself the question, am I happy to be here? Am I trying to get somewhere else? Am I just killing time till lunch? Or am I really happy to be here in this moment, on this chair, in this room, in this body, right now? A lot of times we're never happy to be here. We always think the next place will be better. That's why, you know, even the way I teach, nimittas. Have you had a nimitta yet? How do you know they're any good? You're only trusting me. Jhanas, who knows? Enlightenment, do you really want to get enlightened? Do you know what it actually is talking about? Sometimes it's like going on this magic tours which the airlines used to hold. Mystery tours, that's the word. You don't know where you're going to end up. You trust it somewhere nice. Are you sure you really want to be enlightened? Nah. This was one of my problems when I was at school. When I got to about 15 or 16, I started to get interested in religion. When people ask me why to become a Buddhist, the first school prize I got at 16, I got all the different books on different religions, read them all, and just made a choice. You know what we call that these days? We call it market research. And it's Buddhism, which I like, that's why I became a Buddhist. But I did my research, first of all, before I committed. But I still remember going to see the religious chaplain at the school I went to. Because I was a poor family, but I got scholarships all the way and went to this really good school in West London. And I saw the chaplain, made an appointment, and I asked him, just, "Look, I'm not critical at all, but, your idea of God, what is this God? What is it? And just let me know." And he said, "Oh, God. It is the beginning and end of all things. It's the ineffable. It's beyond words. And he said all this stuff, which was total, the word was codswallop. In other words, it never made any sense. What do you mean the beginning and the end of all? Or the ground of all being? Or beyond words? Can't you describe it? You've committed your life to this. What is it?" And he never gave me a straight answer. And I came away from that little meeting feeling that fellow doesn't understand what God is. If he did, he'd be able to tell me. I was basing that, you know, on a saying by Werner Heisenberg, who was one of the great founders of quantum physics. And he said, you know, people think quantum physics is very complicated. And Werner Heisenberg said, if you understand what it really is, you'll be able to explain it to a barmaid at the pub who's serving you a pint of beer, and the barmaid will be able to understand you. That's a sign of your knowledge and understanding of the subject, that you can explain it to others. I thought, how wise that was. So that's why I rejected the chaplain of that school. And instead I went to the Buddhist temple and asked, I think it was a Sri Lankan monk, said, Nibbana, what's Nibbana? And he said, it's the beginning and end of all things. It's beyond words. It's ineffable. The ground of all being. I've heard that somewhere before. And so I rejected that too. It was only later on when you went to someone like an Ajahn Chah. That is where you get some teachings which you can understand, which makes sense. And that they drive the path forward. So with Ajahn Chah, Nibbana, what's Nibbana? What's enlightenment? What is it? And the explanation is the story. I tell stories because that's what we can understand. Theories, philosophies, we can argue with, but stories are real. You can't really argue with the stories. You just get lots of insight from them at so many different levels. It was the five children playing the wishing game. And the five children playing the wishing game, the rules are this. Each child had one wish. And whoever came up with the best wish would win the wishing game. So the first kid put his hand up and he said, if I had a wish, I wish for this new computer game. Very good. Yeah, good kids like playing computer games. Now, I have no idea what computer games they are. There was one time the monks were giving me a foot massage after a busy weekend, and they started talking about computer games. They were young monks. And I said, I haven't got a clue what you're talking about. It's all gobbledygook to me. I haven't got a clue. And they were all laughing because computer games were, you know, before my time as a monk. And you can't do anything now with computer games. Now you've been a monk for 46 years. But anyway, they're supposed to be really important for kids. A new computer game. Okay, fair enough. The next kid, a girl, what's your best wish? Said, I wish for a computer game shop. If I had my own shop, I'd be able to have not just one computer game, but as many computer games as I want, the latest model whenever it comes out. Yeah, much better wish. And the third boy, he was really smart. The third boy said, if I had a wish, I would wish for $1 billion US. And with $1 billion US, of course, I'd buy my own computer game shop. But the problem is, these days, with kids playing computer games, your parents always tell you to do your homework first. And that's just always such, you know, just a drag having to do homework instead of doing what I really like. So, having got my own computer game shop, then I'll buy my own school. If I own the school and employ the headmaster and all the teachers and everybody else, they have to do what I say, otherwise I give them the sack. So they have to give me top marks even though I don't even go to school. And when I graduate from my primary school, I'll buy my own high school. And then just like Donald Trump, buy my own university. That way I can keep on getting good degrees all my life and I don't even need to do anything. And if there's anything else I think I want, you know, with $1 billion US, you know, you can't spend $1 billion US as a human being unless you're a government. Yeah, you can spend much more than that, but as a human being, that's more than enough to spend for your whole life. Beat that. There are two more children left, remember? So the next child is really an amazing girl. She said, I can beat that, easy. And you can't say $2 billion or $3 billion, because $1 billion is as much money as you can spend. Said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for three wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'll have the computer game shop. For my second wish, I'll have $1 billion US. For my third wish, I'll have 3 more wishes. That way I can go on forever. Beat that. The infinity of wishes. That's a pretty sort of hard thing to beat. But the last child had a wish which easily surpassed the infinity of wishes granted. And that child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes ever again. And that is enlightenment. And that's, I think, beautiful, because it's evocative of the path to enlightenment and what enlightenment actually is. You're so content. The end of desire. You don't need any more wishes anymore. You're happy, no matter what. The one before that, infinity of wishes granted, that's power. That's why wealthy people want to become prime ministers or presidents. I can never figure that out. Why would somebody like a Donald Trump or what was the prime minister before, Scott Morrison, who was incredibly wealthy? Why do you want to sort of have all the worry about running a country for? Sorry? Turnbull, that's right, yeah, thank you. Why do you want to have all that trouble running a country when you've got so much money you can live happily ever after? But this is one of the reasons why, because they want lots of wishes granted. The third child, in great wealth, again, that was not enough. So we have the pleasure of wealth, the pleasure of power. But even more than that, it's a pleasure of contentment. So content, you never needed any more wishes ever again. That was the Buddha. Enlightenment. Very beautiful little way of describing what enlightenment is. And are you happy to be here? So content, you don't need any nimittas, you don't need jhanas, you don't need any enlightenment. Just so content, just happy to be here. Then you're on the path. Then you go in the right direction. You are letting go. Really letting go. Not, well, yeah, I let go to get a jhana. Once I got the jhana, then, okay, fair enough. I want a jhana first. Give me the jhana, Ajahn Brahm, then I'll let go. It never works that way. So when you really have some trust in letting go, the freedom from desire, not the freedom of desire. Just try it, just for a short time. Freedom from desire. Don't want any other desire, just sit here with a sore bum, too hot or too cold, hungry, with a sore tummy, with hay fever. Be content. Then see what happens. Because when there's stillness, things vanish. That's why I was going to talk about the art of disappearing and vanishing. But it's already 4 minutes past 9. So maybe I'll talk about vanishing tomorrow. Sadhu. 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 Very good.